Daniel 3, or Daniel chapter 3, is another familiar story. In the book of Daniel, many of the stories are familiar to us, right? There's this, these are good Sunday school stories. Flannel graphs are conducive to the book of Daniel, if you remember flannel graphs. And this story in particular is one that there's just big events. There's a fiery furnace, right? This is exciting. This is interesting to us. And though it raises the question sometimes when you read that story, what do we do with it, right? Here's the book of Daniel. Here's a wonderful story of deliverance from a fire, to give away the ending that I'm sure we all know. But what do we do with it? This is a story, interestingly, that's been comforting to the church for a lot of years. They have, in the early centuries of the church, around the 3rd and 4th century, they found sarcophagi, sort of tombs, that have this story sort of, I was going to say emblazoned, but that's a bad pun, carved into the side of the tomb, right, of three men in a fire and being delivered. It's interesting. This story has been very comforting to people. And one of the reasons that's true is because it's the moment of trial, right? A moment where everything is falling apart. Life doesn't seem to make sense. It's a difficult moment. And in that space and time, God steps in. And we also like to say there is great faith in these men, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They exemplify great faith for us. But as we read it, we can put ourselves in the place where we say, well, if I just had great faith, God would deliver me from a fiery furnace, right? And that's sometimes how we apply this story. But I hope as we look at it together today, we'll see that there's a little bit more in the story to apply. We can trust God even when the results are uncertain, even when we aren't guaranteed that we get out of the fiery furnace. All right. I'm going to note a couple other things, but I wanted to open it up. What do you know about this story? What do you like about this story? When was the last time you thought about the fiery furnace? Might have been a while. Last Sunday school. Yeah, last time you sat in Sunday school and somebody was like, we're going to talk about the fiery furnace today. May not be a story that we gravitate towards once we've graduated from elementary school. And yet, I hope we see some good things in it. Other thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that. The mysterious fourth individual who appears and brings deliverance. All right, well, let's dive in. This story, we'll see, fits the themes that we've seen in the book of Daniel so far. One thing to note as you read through this is the repetition. There are going to be things repeated. And in English, sometimes we're like, why are we reading all of these things again? But in Hebrew, there's a very intentional move there. Whenever something's repeated, obviously, it's important. And so just as we see that repetition, both in terms of titles of people, in terms of descriptions, and some of the key verbs, when those things are repeated, pay attention. Quick outline for this book. It's going to begin with a decree from the king. It's going to move to a confession and to a decree. Decree, confession, decree. All right, so we're going to read it. We'll read about the first seven verses and kind of unpack it as we go. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." All right. What's one phrase that stuck out about 1,000 times in there?
The titles of the governors.
Yeah. Anything else?
The fiery furnace, no, the statue.
Yeah, that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Mm-hmm. It's about six or seven times in those verses, right? So that's important that he set up this image. And we note right there at the beginning that this image is fairly glorious. It's made of gold. We know from archaeology that it wouldn't have been solid gold, but overlaid in gold. Some substance that would be overlaid with gold. And it's 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. So it's about 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. So that's a significant structure, right, by any estimation. 90 feet is a significant thing. It's also very narrow, right? This is where people get into the weeds on things, and it's like, well, technically, for it to be symmetrical to a human figure, it would only be able to be 35 feet tall, right? So there, and so people speculate maybe this thing's up on a pedestal, or maybe it's just really awkwardly narrow in diameter. But this fits some of the archaeology and the ways that the kings would have built images. It's grand, it's narrow, it points to heaven, all of these things that we see, and it's made of gold. Now, if you were here last week, what does this remind you of? Good guesses. Yes. What was the dream last week? If you look back in Daniel 2, there's this dream, and in this dream there is this image of and we don't really get a full picture of what it's, you know, its dimensions or anything, but it goes from gold to silver to bronze to iron and clay, right? And there's this sense Babylon is the head, and it goes down. And so most people, as they read this, there's a continuity between this. It seems maybe that Nebuchadnezzar took this dream as a warning and said, hey, your kingdom is going to crumble eventually, right? It's not going to last forever. And so the very next thing, at least in the text that we have him doing, is replicating, in a sense, the image that he saw in the dream, but now making it out of solid gold. There's no clay feet. There's no weakness here. This is all glorious and all in front of his people. We actually have, they've dug up in Babylon, so to speak, an inscription, not specifically about this image, it doesn't seem, but it reminds us of what kings would do in this day. So this is around the time of Babylon. It says, or around the time of Nebuchadnezzar. This is an inscription that they found. Beside my statue as king, I wrote an inscription mentioning my name. I erected for posterity. May future kings respect the monument. Remember the praise of the gods. He who respects my royal name, who does not diminish my status and does not change my decrees, his throne shall be secure. His life lasts long. His dynasty shall continue. That gets us at the rationale maybe for what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. He doesn't like the dream particularly. He's fine with it in a sense. He's the head of gold. That's good. But there's a sense that his kingdom is going to diminish. So what does he do? He builds this statue and he gets everybody there. Verse 2, right? He gathers all of these people, the satraps. Those are just rulers of provinces in Babylon, basically. Prefects, governors, all the different people. He gets them together and says, you're going to come to this dedication. Now he just invites them to a dedication. And what are you going to do if you're one of these people? You're going to show up, right? You're invited. The king says, come. You say, there's probably a good after party to this gathering. This is opulence. It's all these sort of things. And so this has been erected on the plain of Dura, it says, and that seems to be maybe a suburb of Babylon. People speculate maybe it was sort of built out there in secret and then he gathered everybody, or he was sort of doing this in various places to sort of solidify his rule, and that does seem to be the purpose here. As he gathers everybody, he, in verse 3, again, they're all listed there again, and they're to come and stand before this image. And then the herald says this, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages. Now that gives us a clue as to who these people are. They're not just all good Babylonians. These are the people from the conquered nations that Babylon uses to rule, right? Like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those men were sort of Jews taken into exile, but then used to run the Babylonian Empire. And so really what's happening here is all the people used to gather or to run the Babylonian Empire are gathered and said, basically, come and swear fealty to the king, right? This is what's at stake here. It's okay if you want to worship your other gods, but here's the real deal. Here's Babylon. Here is this image. And we can debate a little bit in a moment what this image is, whether it's King Nebuchadnezzar himself or if it is a representation of a god. The text doesn't necessarily say, except that it keeps saying that Nebuchadnezzar set it up. That's really the thrust of what the narrative is showing us. And so you think, all right, this isn't a big deal for most people. I can go and do this. And then there's this curious signal of all these different music instruments. Did anybody know bagpipes are in the Bible? That's a fun little tidbit. Speaking of that, I was curious. So I went on YouTube to try to find like a Babylonian bagpipe. There weren't a lot. But there was this early precursor instrument to the traditional Scottish bagpipe, where they basically take a goat and they put like the whole goat skin, they stitch it up together, they blow it on one end, and they have like a reed on the other end. And it sounds really kind of like what you think it was. It sounds like a primitive bagpipe. All that to say, there's this hodgepodge. Another side note, I didn't realize this, but we get the Greek word for bagpipe is where we get our English word symphony from. So I didn't know that. So you can like bagpipes now because we got our symphony word from that. Anyways, it sounds like a cacophony, but it might have sounded very melodious, all these instruments together. And this is a signal. And it's arguable that even all these instruments are sort of a pooling from all the other nations as Babylon would do this. And really, when they hear this, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to bow before the image. And so what happens? They hear it, verse 7, and they fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And so far, nobody's been named in this, right? We don't see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We don't see Daniel. We actually never see Daniel in this text. And that does lead to some debate. Where is Daniel? It's possible that he was just sort of too elevated in the palace sort of system that he didn't need to be here. He could have been away. People, you know, speculate. But he's not in the story. And so our attention will turn to his friends in a moment. But think here for a moment. What's the problem here? What do God's people have a problem with in this instance? What can't they do? They're not supposed to worship any god. Really, it's a violation of the first and the second commandment, that they're not supposed to have any gods before him, and the second commandment, not to make any images of God. And, I mean, we hear that, and we're like, yeah, they weren't supposed to do that. But how big of a deal does that actually seem to us? Right? We know the first and second commandments are real commandments. I'm not debating that or submitting to them. But we also think those are the easiest commandments, right? Especially when we read, you shall have no other gods. And we'll get into that. We know idolatry. But these are often commandments that we look at this and we say, how foolish could these people be, right? Bowing down before the image. And I think that's the one thing that we need to kind of get in our brains as we read this, that this was a normal thing to do, right? This was just sort of a normal course of living in this day, is that gods had power and everybody just sort of thought they did. And these people too, they honestly, they didn't bow down before these images and say, that's my God, right? They knew that there was a representation of a God there. We found in some of these cultures in the ancient Near East, ceremonies by which after they had made the idol, they would invite the God to sort of reside in the idol. So they knew there was a spiritual reality behind what they saw here. And they actually thought this worked. They thought idolatry was an effective way of doing this, of caring for a God, ministering to the God, and he would then care for them. It seemed practical to them. So what they're asked to do here is not just like, okay, we're just going to pretend that there's a God here. They actually thought that there was some representation of a God behind that. And so it's understandable that they would have been participants in this. But clearly, God's people are not allowed to do this, right? Exodus 20, the first verses there will tell them that they are to have no other gods and to make no other images. All right, so what do? You're a good little Babylonian in this gathering, and you're also a Jew, and you know you're not supposed to bow down. What do you do? We all know the right answer, right? I would have stood up bravely and taken my consequences in the fiery furnace. What do? Do you try to do like a half bow? Be like, well, maybe nobody will really notice me. Are there like, you know, Babylonian guards posed around with like clipboards watching to see who bows? I mean, we need to kind of put ourselves in the moment a little bit. What would you do in this moment?
I Should don't show up.
Don't show up. Yeah. I would have found a way not to be there. Yeah. Well, no, exactly. We would have got creative. Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if, and all these people, the satraps, prefects, governors, mm-hmm. I wonder how many of them were actually Jewish. Because those were the only people that were at the dedication, or that's what I'm hearing, mm-hmm. that's what I'm reading.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, you know, it's possible that there are other Jews amongst this group. We just don't, we just know. It's all the people, all the conquered people gathering. But, they're leaders, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All their leaders are gathering, yeah.
I suppose another issue is whether you think there's a life threat if you don't do this.
Yeah. Is he actually going to follow through?
He doesn't say this or anything about it.
Well, no, it says that they'll be thrown into a fiery furnace.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
Is he going to be real? Is he actually going to do it? Last time, right, he threatened to dismember us, and he didn't. Nebuchadnezzar, right? So maybe some people are going to hedge their bets, not show up. I like that answer. Be like, I'm going to find a way to sleep in that day and hope nobody notices. Yeah. I think it's a fair question, right? I know we all know the right answer, and we know that, but we also know the temptation in a moment like this to sort of capitulate, to give in to the moment, and to find a way to sort of avoid it or not have to deal with it. Any other thoughts there? Yeah, Dave.
Well, through the centuries, there's always been that problem within the church of what do you do with even ministers
mm-hmm.
that have given up the faith under persecution, and then later on, when the persecution disappears, they want to come back to the faith.
Yeah, yeah. That if that's the Donatist controversy. So, if, like 4th century, you have the persecution ending largely in the church, and you have all these people that sort of gave up the faith and all this sort of thing. And the question is, like, are the baptisms still valid? Do we let these people back in? And the church decided largely to say, yes, we can welcome these people back in, which is an interesting note in church history. And it's not wrong to, in this moment, like, think through the lens of church history. There are also many other times where there have been very tangible requests to deny the faith. And that's functionally sort of what's happening here. Nebuchadnezzar, like I said earlier, he's fine if people want to worship their own gods as long as he's in the mix. As long as the Babylonian gods are in the mix. Marduk is sort of their chief god. As long as you're willing to sort of worship that, then you can worship your own gods. But that doesn't fit with Judaism. There's this, or with Christianity, there's this clear line. Just like in the early church, right? The Christians were asked to basically curse Christ and to worship the emperor, right? It was sort of, and they were okay with you even just doing it sort of perfunctory, just sort of go do it. And then some Christians would even buy, you could buy a certificate of renouncing Christ, and you could show it to people and say, no, don't worry, you don't need to persecute me, I've renounced Christ. And so at various points in church history, this has been a live question. One of the things that's interesting is this is very dramatic, right? It's like, bow down now. Maybe as we get into this a little more, we can talk about the more subtle ways that we might capitulate in these moments rather than sort of stay and confess Christ regardless of the consequences. But let's dive in. Let's read these next verses so we can actually see how these men that we haven't yet met in this particular story interact. So picking up in verse 8, and we'll read through verse 15. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? A few things to note, going back to verse 8. We have these malicious Chaldeans that kind of come. They're like, they're the ones who, and Chaldeans, remember, kind of the leaders in the bureaucracy. And so they've noted that there are these guys that haven't obeyed. And we don't know their motive. Maybe they're just being, as one person or one commentary put it, obnoxious busybodies. And they're kind of like, ha, we found somebody. What's he going to do? Is he actually going to burn these people? Or maybe they're actually malicious against these people. Maybe there's a sense that they have had a grudge against these Jews for the success that they've had, the positions that God has brought them into. I think that's a very likely way of, or a likely thing motivating them. And so they come to the king, and as they are wont to do, they sort of flatter him a little bit. Oh, king, live forever. You have made this decree. You've done all this. And at the same time, they sort of say, hey, you put these guys in a position. Maybe you made a mistake. Maybe you made a mistake, and now you can fix it, because they don't seem to be loyal Babylonians. They pay no attention to you, and that's not okay. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that they have set up. And so they sort of egg the king on a little bit, and as you see in verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar is furious. And what's interesting, he's furious, and then what does he do? We might think he's going to go throw him in the furnace right away, but he actually goes, and maybe with some good judgment, reaches out to them and says, hey, would you come and let's talk this out? So he inquires, and he basically gives them a second chance, even though he's furious with rage. And he says, next time you hear this all, you can do it again. And then he asks the question that is really behind much of what we see in this passage. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Has Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson? No. He's probably not going to learn his lesson for a while. Arguably, he doesn't learn his lesson very well throughout the whole book of Daniel. But now the situation has gotten more problematic. Things are really at a head. And so the question again is, what do you do now? Now you've been singled out. Now you can't sleep in anymore. Now you're sitting there. You're caught in your transgression, so to speak, against the king. And what should you do?
Stand firm.
Yeah. What do you think is going through these individuals' mind? We'll see their response in a moment in verse 16. But what are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thinking?
We're gonna die.
Yeah. Where's Daniel? Right. Yeah. We're gonna die. Like it's and we'll see their response. There's this faith, but there's also mixed in that faith a sense of uncertainty. They're very confident, but there also is some question. Other thoughts. Yeah.
Go ahead.
The Chaldeans are the same people that these guys went up against with the dream, mm-hmm. thing, and they showed them all up. And then in the dream, with the dream, Daniel was paramount. But now with this one, these other three, his friends are paramount.
Yeah.
In that.
Yeah. Yeah. They're now the ones that are facing the Babylonian onslaught. Yeah. Great.
It's interesting because the more you try to avoid having to do something like this, mm-hmm. if you are sleeping in or
yeah.
trying to avoid it, how do I put this? It's going to come for you,
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to get squeezed to the point that you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we think we can negotiate with quote-unquote God's enemies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that in a violent sense.
Yeah, yeah,
I just mean that you think you can negotiate with idolatry, but you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, I mean, this is the Lord himself.
Yeah.
He is sovereign.
Yeah.
Putting you in this position.
Mm-hmm. You can read this. There are different major themes you could pull up. One is that they're actually being, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are being tested in their faith, right? Are you going to be faithful? Right, and yeah, you can, it's unavoidable, like the collision course here. And that's really what the book of Daniel is, sort of the big picture. Like, this is really what's happening. And then the invitation for us is to then say, how do we live that out in our normal daily expressions? And admittedly, sometimes this seems very distant, right? Nobody's literally burning, has a furnace sort of kindling out there, right? But the underlying realities are nonetheless real. And the question is, what do we do when the pressure is on? It's interesting, and maybe we don't catch it directly, but I think there's Daniel, as this is sort of written after the fact, there's a little bit of a playful mocking tone towards Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know if you catch that, but he's this whole thing. He set it up. That's sort of the repetition there is sort of showing the reader even now that this God or this guy who thinks he's God really doesn't have the power he thinks he does. And yet in the experience of God's people in that moment, he has real power over them. And that's sort of put together as the reader outside the text, and this is why the story is great for kids, is we know God's going to win, right, as we're reading. But in the moment, these people have real questions about how this will all play out. So let's read their response in verse 16 through 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. It's quite the response. There's faith. They're saying, we don't have to answer you. And the language there, it doesn't sound like they're not just being flippant with the king. That's actually probably some Babylonian sort of legal terms. It's like, we don't have standing to talk to you about this. That's kind of what they're getting at. But the theological part really comes in those next two verses. God is able to deliver us from your hand, and he will deliver us. But if not, be it known to you, king, that we will not worship. And so I think this is why Christians have found hope in the book of Daniel. This is a very, it's a faith-filled response, isn't it? Of somebody confronting what may be certain death and saying, we still will not worship. We will not do that. And that's remarkable. This is really a key turning point. It all hinges on what happens next. Now who are we waiting for to act in the story? God. We're waiting. Will God show up in the way that these folks anticipate, the way that these guys desire? Is God going to be the one who is there for us? And now we get to find out. But any other thoughts there before we get to the true answer? Do you guys have, are you confident either in this moment you'd do this, right? And I think all of it, and that's, I think all of us would say, I don't know what I would do in that moment.
I know this is back in that day, but missionaries go through this all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? So,
yeah.
And having to make that very hard decision, that many of them have been put to death, so.
We live in a, this question is removed for us in a way that's privileged,
yes.
Use that word,
yes.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You can go through a church history and see many moments where there's, persecution in Japan in the early centuries, right? There was very much like, and there's a novel Silence is a book that recounts some of that, but it's based on some history. And there are moments where it's like, here's the image of Christ, you walk on it or you die, right? You step on the image of Christ or you die. Like that, this is not outside the realm of church history.
This has echoes of what was going on with Pharaoh and in Egypt. And Egypt and Babylon are two big things all the way through Israel's history. But it's just amazing that God took the time to go
mm-hmm.
after this one leader.
Mm-hmm.
But then also he showed to the Gentiles from the beginning. He's revealing himself not only to his own people, but also to all the rest of us
yeah.
who are around.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and there's a real... when we get to the application, one of the things we can look at is who learns from this story, right? And a lot of people read this and will say, some of the people that learn from the story is all the other people who bowed, right? Because they saw these guys not do it. They saw their God deliver them. And that's a powerful witness in this moment, right? Because the chatter in the courtyard of the king is going to be like, whoa, they're what's happening? They didn't bow, right? What's going to happen? And it's to see God's provision, like you're saying there. It is interesting to consider that, and it not to get we can go into so many different case studies or specific examples about how much the church should say against authorities and all those kind of things, but we'll go through the text. I've got lots of tangential stories we could talk about. But I will say this. There was a pastor in Germany leading up to, well, he was in Germany leading up to World War II. His name is Paul Schneider. And one of the things, he wrote this in a letter to his wife while he was in a concentration camp. And he said, it's not that we said too much, it's that we said too little. It was a really interesting kind of response in his response to leading up to the Nazis coming. The flip side of that, though, and this is what's interesting, I think that's, we resonate with that, and I think that's the right response in hindsight to those moments, is that, this is dumb, I don't know why I'm doing this off memory, but the 1933, Hitler kind of becomes Chancellor of Germany. His percentage of the popular vote, or the election that was held before he kind of took the chancellorcy, he only got about 20% in change in the popular vote. And it's just an interesting thing. Sometimes we think if the church had just said something more, everybody would have like said Hitler's terrible and nothing would have happened. But there were like dozens and dozens of pastors in their pulpits, not being explicitly political, but saying, you guys are capitulating to the spirit of the age, right? And Hitler won regardless of what the polls said and like those sorts of things. So it's an interesting counterpoint. Sometimes we say, if we just said the right thing at the right time, all would go well. And then you look at history and like people said the right thing at the right time. And God in his sovereignty is using all of these things and directing them. And so it's a little interesting, right? And I think that's why Daniel's, these words are so helpful, because it's saying, we need to stay here, we need to take the stand. And then things might go really bad. Or they might go really good, right? But it's our faithfulness rather than sort of a we need to reclaim. Their goal here is not to sort of say, hey, we're going to take over your kingdom. But instead, we're going to say, hey, we're going to be faithful because we have a true king. Just something to think about. Lots we could go into there. Let's see what happens. Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression on his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he was angry, he was furious with rage. Now he's filled with fury. It's an escalation. He's even more angry than he was before. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. All right, so the worst happened. They haven't been delivered yet. They're thrown in. And think about this moment. Some interesting notes. We don't know exactly what this fiery furnace is. Most people think it's some sort of kiln. Maybe it was actually used to help build the statue that we've seen already. But it's heated up to its max capacity. Now, 7 times hotter is probably a bit of a hyperbole, just saying it's heated as hot as it can go. This is where people like to analyze these things. But they estimate that these, you know, Babylonian kilns would have ran about 900 to 1100 degrees Celsius. So that's like their normal operating temperature, but they max out at 1500 degrees, apparently. So if somebody's like, well, it's impossible for it to be 7 times hotter. That's not the point. The point is they've made this fire as hot as it can get. It's raging. It's ready to go. And so we see that there's clearly an entry to this furnace of some kind. Maybe there's a window later, needs some ventilation, but the bellows have been sort of stoked. This fire is at max capacity. And they're throwing in with all of their garments on, all these things that are flammable, and they are bound, understandably so. And they need these men, though, to put the men into the fire, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego aren't going to just walk in. And so in verse 22, we see, because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. One of the things is, I mean, it's kind of a sad story, right? Obviously, these Babylonians are killed. Obviously, not innocent men, but regardless, they're part of this thing. The king doesn't seem to care about them. He just wants these other men done away with. Now you're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, though. And you're like, oh, okay. I'm in the furnace, right? Like, I'm falling in. This is happening. God has not stopped us. What are you thinking?
man, it's hot.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I don't know, the sensations, all those kind of things. It's like, you know, and you can see it. Like, they're literally being picked up, and you've stood near a fire before, right? You've burnt yourself, maybe been dumb and been too close to a fire. It's hot. And all of that sort of thing. And to underscore the validity of what's happening, right? These three other men die, or however men it is that are binding them. Some of the mighty men. God has, at this point, and again, I'm not trying to sort of be facetious, but we need to read the story slowly and take it moment by moment to see really what's happening. God hasn't stopped, has he? At this point. We know what's coming. It's coming. But you're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And your assumption, probably at this point, maybe you still have a distant hope. Maybe you say God can still do something. Maybe that's how they were thinking. But,
well, but their response was, even if God doesn't save us, we don't care what you do to us, because it's not going to matter.
Yeah, if death's the consequence, we're resigned
to
that.
So be it. But if he does, you need to know that we're not going to worship anything that you put up.
Absolutely.
They still could have recanted at any time, and they didn't.
Yeah, they could have yelled. They could have been like, okay, God's not here yet.
But once they're tossed in, it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah, no, at that point,
you know,
it's over in their minds in terms of recanting. But yeah, they could have. There's all these things that could have happened. They're literally sort of standing on the edge of the door or the top of this furnace, and they're going in. And one of the points that people often make with this that I think is a fair point to make is sometimes God saves us not from trial, but through trial,
right?
Sometimes God doesn't save us from difficult things, but he walks with us through them. Maybe more often than not, that's how he chooses to do that, right? It's probably too much to use the language of refining fire in response to this. That's not really what's happening here, but we know that reality, that God takes us through difficult things so that we reflect his image, so that we live as he would have us live. Okay. Any other thoughts on these men who are now in the fire? Just waiting. I'm always curious, like, how long did this happen? Did they feel the heat? Did they not feel the heat? I've got questions, but because their clothes don't get singed. We'll see that in a moment. But in this moment, they're in there. All right, 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three bound men into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. The appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." All right, we'll stop there. Here is some sort of deliverance already. They're walking around in the fire, right? This is clearly not just walking on coals. This is a burning fire, and they are there. They are unharmed and unbound. It's interesting that the king is watching. We don't know what the logistics of that, but he's clearly come to see this execution. And then he asks the question, he gets the answer, and there's this fourth, like a son of the gods. God has done something. God has delivered his people. In this moment, they are no longer alone, but God has come near to them in the middle of this fiery ordeal. Who is this fourth figure? There's really two views on it. One is that it's sort of a pre-incarnate Christ who comes and ministers to these people, and the other is that it's an angel. Very few people will be dogmatic in coming down on one of those things. But those are the two views that are there. And Nebuchadnezzar, later on in this passage, I think in verse 28, maybe a little 27, mentions that it's an angel that he saw. But we're going off what Nebuchadnezzar sees here. That's our only witness to this event in the text. He sees four men unbound. So their bonds have been broken by the fourth man, and now they are walking unharmed. And this, again, we hear this and we say, that's wonderful. Of course, God came through. And that is the wonderful, beautiful truth, that God actually does deliver his people. And this is the picture that we see in Scripture again and again. Two places that I think God's people, when they read this, things they would have been reminded of. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 20, talking about God's people being brought out of slavery in Egypt, it says that they were saved through the iron furnace. Egypt is often called an iron furnace in scripture, and they were saved from that. And maybe one that you're more familiar with, Isaiah 43, verses 1 and 2, which was written before this account in Daniel, says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze." We don't know exactly what these men said when they got out, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of those things were on their minds and in their hearts, realizing God's true deliverance. And it's miraculous, right? This is a true miracle. The king is astonished. I would wager that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are also in the camp of being somewhat astonished that they are in a fiery furnace and not being consumed. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I can imagine up to the point that they were tossed in, they were probably thinking, well, somehow or other, God's going to rescue us. Mm-hmm. From this. And then when they were tossed in, it was like, I can't imagine how this is going to come out well. And probably thought they were going to die probably pretty instantly,
yeah.
I would think.
Yeah.
And then as they're walking around, probably thinking, well, I never imagined this.
Mm-hmm.
Never imagined a rescue like this.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Abraham sacrificing Isaac.
Yeah. At the last minute. Yeah. And that one actually is a test, like explicitly in the text,
I wonder, though, if the angel, the fourth person,
mm-hmm.
will it be an angel of the
pre-incarnate
Christ, I wonder if he was already in there and just didn't make himself seen until the three guys were in there.
It's possible. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of a shadowy figure, right? He just sort of comes and then he disappears again, right? Once they... in the next part where he calls them out. Yeah, and whether it's an angel or Christ, the early church were the first people, obviously, to see Christ in here, right? They started looking at the Old Testament and they saw those sorts of things. But there isn't a lot textually that requires that. It's hard to, like, it makes sense given what we know of Christ and how he works. Maybe the really neat thing is God could have saved his people just with a word, right? He could have save them just by redirecting the king or changing the king's mind, but he chose to save them with presence,
mm-hmm.
An angelic presence or the presence of Christ. And I think that is helpful to us, seeing God with his people in the fire. I think that's what we're supposed to see in the text by this fourth person being present. God isn't just sort of on his throne saying, hey, just get out of here, or something like that. He sends, he comes, and he is near to us, even as we saw in that Isaiah 43 passage, I will be with you. And that's what we see sort of depicted for us, God being with his people, whether as an angel or as Christ. I think that's what we should walk away with hope and with confidence. Other thoughts? Anybody want to stake their claim and say, this is definitely Christ, this is definitely an angel?
I don't think it matters.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair reading. I think we often... just assume one or the other, but
I do think this is a good illustration of when we face what we think are impossible situations that we're hoping that God will rescue.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what we imagine how he's going to do it, oftentimes, assuming there is a rescue or a provision, it is not the way it happened.
Yeah.
And this is a good illustration of that.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have ever thought that that's what he would do,
yeah.
or how he would do it?
Yeah, you would think changing Nebuchadnezzar's mind would be a little easier,
yeah.
right? In our minds, and arguably, yes, it would. And I think that's part of the point, right? He brings them into the fire, gives his presence with them, and takes them out. And that's analogous to our lives. That's how God works with us. Psalm 23: Walking through the shadow of the valley of death, right? I am with you. Those are the things we see again and again in Scripture. In moments of trial, God is near to his people. And that's the theological reason why people sort of start seeing Christ in this instance. It's a theological reason to see him. Textually, there's nothing in the text that says this has to be Christ. But I like some of the, there's some cheeky early church sort of writers on this and say, well, I'm not taking a pagan's view on this, right? Because Nebuchadnezzar's the one who's seeing. It's like, well, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't know what he's thinking, so it's got to be Christ. Just sort of a funny way of them reading. Beside the point, as we said, this is God near to his people. All right, what does Nebuchadnezzar do? Verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their head was not singed. Their cloaks were not harmed. And no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. That's quite the turn of events from this king, Nebuchadnezzar. What does he say? Verse 26, the Most High God. He's acknowledging that Yahweh has power over his gods. Marduk and everybody else that he would have worshipped, he's seeing as the Most High God. Now again, this isn't a confession of faith. He's not becoming a Jew and follower of God here in this moment, but he's acknowledging what he sees, that God of Israel has power. And all these other people sort of come in and they examine these men. And just, I love that detail in the text. It's usually the picture, you might picture these guys kind of coming out covered in soot, smelling bad, sort of their clothes mostly burned off. It's like, whew, we got out of there. But they walk out unharmed. I was telling Jim, right, there was somebody burning, and if you walked into the Life Center this morning, it smelled like brisket to me. I got really hungry, but it was just like the residual smoke from yesterday. Somebody's burning like next door, and it's still there, right? If you've been by a campfire, you know that like your clothes are going to smell like smoke after three washes, right? Like it stays with you. And here, they're not even singed. I think it's just a beautiful little detail in the text. God's power is not just sort of getting these people out by the skin of their teeth, so to speak, but they are unharmed.
How many thousand times they had to tell that story the rest of their lives?
Yeah, tell me about the fire, right? Like, was it hot? Did you lose your eyebrows? Right? Yeah. Have you ever singed your eyebrows?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, really. Like, okay, fine. We'll tell their grandkids want to hear the fiery furnace story. And what a remarkable, and we'd said this earlier, right? All these people are now witnesses to God's power. And that's part of the purpose of this story. All the leaders, all the people that had gathered from all the nations of Babylon now realize that there is a God more powerful than Babylon. A God who, even though his people are in captivity, is still in control. And I think that's a really difficult thing, because if you're conquered in this day and age, your God, therefore, is not powerful. That's sort of the picture, right? Your God has been plundered, right? Daniel 1 began that way. Nebuchadnezzar goes to the temple, takes the gold from the temple, and brings it back to his temple. That's like proof positive that your God is not as powerful. But ultimately, now that all the nations are gathered together, we see that God is the one who's actually powerful. God is the one who's actually in control. Even so, that the fire has no power over these bodies of these men. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 28, says it's an angel. And then he frames it really well. Oftentimes, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who sort of says the theologically true thing at the end of the book, or at the end of the story. And that's what he says here. They trusted in him and set aside the king's command, or they changed. They disregarded the king's command, which is not something you do in Babylon and get away with it. But now the king is commending them for doing it. And yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. And so at this point, we're happy for these people, we're rejoicing, and then it gets a little more, or better, or maybe more complex. Verse 29, therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who was able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. All right, the promotion makes sense, right? This happens often at the end of these stories in Daniel. Things go well. You want people that are, you know, have good gods in charge of things, and so they get promoted. But what do we make of verse 29? I remember, this is, remember this now, we had a cassette tape growing up that had stories from the Old Testament. And I think this was on side B of the cassette tape. And somebody dramatically read this story. And I remember getting to this verse and being kind of really excited as like a 10-year-old probably listening to it. Because what happens? God's people win. Like, you have a royal law that everybody has to be a Christian now, right? And if you aren't, your house gets bulldozed and you get ripped from limb from limb. And as a 10-year-old, I thought this was a really good idea. I remember hearing it. I was like, but my question then was like, well, what happened? If that was the law, then like, why didn't everybody just start loving Jesus, right? It's an interesting, it's a fairly simple question, but it's an interesting dynamic. Yeah, Jane.
That's all that happened, though. The decree is don't speak bad about him.
Right.
It doesn't say.
It doesn't, it's not a forced conversion.
Yeah.
But it is sort of saying this God is one to be respected.
Right.
Yeah.
So just don't say anything. It's kind of like in Caesar's day, you know, Jesus mm-hmm. says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. The Jews, it doesn't say worship this God alone. It just says don't say anything bad about him.
Yeah, you're right.
So,
that's fair.
I'm older than 10.
The confession that God is almighty.
It is privileging Yahweh above all the other gods. Yeah, it's not a forced confession. You're absolutely right. But there is a sense that it's really interesting that that is given to the people, and yet things don't go super well the rest of the time. Dave, what were you going to say?
Well, to me, it's slightly interesting that this was such an impressive situation to Nebuchadnezzar that he did say, well, God, their God is the most powerful God. Mm-hmm. But he didn't go on and say, forget all these others.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's they always included them.
Just totally disregard them.
Yeah.
He kind of kept them in the mix somehow or other.
Yeah.
It's kind of like present-day Japan. You know, they have a whole mm-hmm. pantheon in Rome.
Yeah.
A whole pantheon of gods.
Yeah.
You know, and Yahweh could be part of it, but just don't disregard ours.
Yeah. Yeah. But what is interesting in this moment, the last part of his decree in verse 29, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way.
Right.
That's kind of the point that I think we can wrestle with a little bit, because there's this understanding now. His decree was initially, right, worship me or fiery furnace. Now it's saying, here's Yahweh. He is better than everybody else. Yes, not asking to worship, but he is sort of saying, this is a God to take note of. And most of us would say, we'd like that if that was the law of the land, right? Would we prefer that? I don't know. It's an interesting question. It's getting into the weeds a little bit. But I think it's interesting to think about what happens then. Right, we'll see in this next part next week that Nebuchadnezzar praises God, but ultimately this doesn't lead to God's people flourishing in the land. It's not because of this decree, but it's because of the faith of people like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that actually leads to the flourishing of God's people. And we see that with the church, right? When legal protection comes in the church, it doesn't necessarily mean that the church suddenly explodes. Often it's the opposite. Often it's when there's difficulty for the church that the church really flourishes the way that God asks it to. So what do we do with this story? We're now 21st century Christians living in relative comfort. What do we do with this story? Is it merely preparation for future fiery furnaces?
I think it says more about providence,
okay,
which is not a concept that I grew up thinking much about or being taught about.
Yeah.
But as we're talking this morning, I'm just sitting here thinking about the difference in Nebuchadnezzar and Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
Pharaoh saw 10 or so pretty amazing things himself, and yet it didn't make much of an impression on him. And even the death angel visit, he sort of recanted after that,
yeah.
Decided to go after him anyway. Mm-hmm. So God was just as much at work there as he was with Nebuchadnezzar. Why did Nebuchadnezzar, I guess, have a change of heart or at least change of outlook?
Yeah.
Pharaoh didn't. Well, God was doing different things at different times and different lives and different personalities.
Yeah.
And yet, it was God who was in control, not the personalities who were in control.
Yeah. I think that's God's sovereignty. Really, I think there are two main ways of reading Daniel, or two themes. One is living well in exile, but the other one is God's sovereignty.
Yeah.
And I think those things come together, right? God is the sovereign king, right? Nebuchadnezzar asked that question, right? I think it's verse 15, like, which God is going to save you? And he asked a similar question back in chapter 2. It's like, what God can interpret this, right? And the point is that there is a God who is sovereign, right? And I think Pharaoh is the helpful parallel, right, of doing a king doing similar, responding well, poorly, hardening heart, soft, like back and forth, right? But God is the one who's in control.
Yeah, and we've got God's own words saying, I hardened his heart for my purpose.
Yeah, and when God is in control, we don't have to trust idols. I think that's part of what's here, right? And again, I think that's something we might, with our Western eyes, we miss this a little bit in the text, is because it would be really easy for these Jews to see this golden statue, know all the Babylonian theology, know everything about it, and really ask the existential question, did Yahweh lose, right? Because it seems like he did. Anecdotally in their lives, it seems like the God of Israel has lost. And we, analogous to that, when we look at our lives and we're just trying to solve our solutions, right, it's really easy to say, I'm going to figure it out in my own power, in my own sort of idolatrous way, whatever those idols, whatever is sort of what you lean and trust in. That's kind of what they're doing. And in exile, right, what do exiles do? They tend, after a few generations, to worship the gods of the new place. They assimilate into the world, right? I see this in my family. So my dad is a first-generation immigrant from the Netherlands to Canada. He counts as first generation because he was 3 months old when he moved. So sort of second generation. But he did that, right? And what did all the Dutch people do? They all had churches that met together and met in the Dutch language. And they started Dutch schools and all those sorts of things. Both my parents didn't know English when they went to kindergarten or first grade in Canada. They learned English when they showed up at a school and were like, hey, we're in English. And then I'm the third generation, roughly, from that. And I married somebody who wasn't Dutch. And Virginia, the first time she met, I was in college, and she met my grandparents and two of my great aunt and uncle. And they took us out to Cracker Barrel. And they spent 30 minutes trying to find somebody Dutch in her tree. And they were really concerned. They weren't actually concerned, but they had a tough time getting their brain around the fact that you weren't Dutch, right? And it was really, and I say that all because that's normal, right? And it's sort of, I'm not saying what I did, I'm just not how some terrible person who didn't marry the Dutch person. Like, that's not the story. But assimilation happens really quickly. We get so used to the cultural norms and the idolatry of it, and we just live for those things. And these people in Daniel are resisting that. They're working hard at that. That's why they eat the vegetables back in chapter 1. Probably not because it was, those vegetables might have been sacrificed to idols too. Kind of all the food was sacrificed to idols. But they didn't want to step into the opulence of Babylon and say, this is really great. I want to feast every day. Limitless feasts at the king's table. And they said, no, I need to guard myself from being drawn to that idolatry. And so that's what they're doing. And they're seeing that God is sovereign in the midst of this. And so there's a lot of things to apply there. One is looking at our own idolatry. Where do we worship the same gods as the nation around us? And where are we, and along with that, obedience costs people stuff in the book of Daniel. Obedience is not easy. Did you catch that through that? Anytime they obey, there's immediately a crisis. They obey by not eating the food. They obey sort of by interpreting the dream. They obey by not bowing here. Daniel, in next week, will obey by not praying, or he will obey by praying, and end up in the lion's den, right? Obedience is costly. And then the question for us is, where is our obedience costly? Sometimes obeying, if our obedience isn't costly, I'm saying this sort of without any nuance. Maybe we are worshiping idols more than we think we are. If our obedience isn't costly, maybe we're worshiping idols. If it's easy for us to obey God, maybe we're not obeying to the degree we think we are. And I think that's interesting in the book of Daniel to see. And then the comfort in all of this is we are not alone in our trial. We're not alone in this. We aren't just sort of thrown out and say, don't worship idols, obey me. God is near to his people, right? Even though when we pass through the fire, he will be with us. And where do we see that most clearly? We see that in the incarnation. We see that in Christ who comes and steps into our world and redeems us. So those are some thoughts on Daniel. We're over time. I had a little story about the KGB and stuff, but it's kind of convoluted to explain, so we're going to skip that. And it was debatable, but yeah. It had the word babushka in it, which was fun. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for your nearness to us. Lord, would we resist the things that are to be resisted in our world? Would you give us wisdom to even know what those are, where we are tempted to be idolaters, where we are idolaters, where we haven't obeyed? Lord, would you show us that you are near to us, that Christ has come near to us, that we have a kingdom that is better than Babylon, that rock that has come and smashed all the other kingdoms is here in Christ, and would we cling to that? We pray this in your name. Amen.